The Debate.
According to the International Criminal Court, it has confirmed that there is a reasonable basis to believe that members of the British Armed Forces committed the war crimes of willful killing, torture, inhumane cruel treatment, outrages upon personal dignity, and rape and or other forms of sexual violence. And what do you think the ICC did when they found out this information? They closed the case. That's right. We will be taking a look at Western privilege in the international arena and the lack of accountabilities for lives lost or destroyed in developing countries. In this debate this hour, I'd like to welcome to the program out of London, Press TV's Richard Sudan, and out in Edinburgh, author and commentator John White. Thank you both for being with us. Starting it off with Richard. Well, Richard, tell me about what's being said on that side of things. It is quite curious that after admitting that there were war crimes committed, that the ICC then closed the case.
I mean, I think, Marzia, in your introduction, you mentioned the phrase Western privilege, and I think that's a really good starting point. I mean, frankly, there are going to be scores of human rights lawyers and experts, scores of anti-war activists that are going to be looking at the decision by the chief prosecutor, who said there's no case for the British to answer to, with utter disbelief, because in spite of all of the accounts, all of the testimony, all of the evidence that's been put forward, really, in addition to what we already knew, it seems something that, on the one hand, there's been some sort of admission that the British Army military command did indeed contribute to suspected war crimes committed against the Iraqi detainees. But on the other hand, I think the decision mentioned that it's satisfied that the British authorities conducted their own investigation. On what planet, amid what semblance of fairness and true democracy, can the party which is being accused of committing the war crimes somehow be, the vindicator that there were none committed? It beggars belief, and I suspect, the international community is really looking at this decision with a kind of side-eye squint, also in a sense of disbelief, as are much of the British people.
All right. Well, John, let me get you in on this conversation. What do you make of this? How is that from a legal perspective? I mean, how does it make sense? So there is a court. The court says, yes, we see proof of war crimes being taken out and that's taken place, and yet the case is closed. And what type of signal, what message does this basically send to the world?
Well, good evening, Amina, and good evening, Richard. There are times when the truth is not enough, and when only the unvarnished truth will do. And when we come to an unvarnished truth of this development, let us be honest, this is not about Western privilege per se, this is about white supremacy. The problem disfiguring our world today is not the lack of democracy within states, it's the lack of democracy between states. And this merely confirms it, because what we have are a clutch of Western imperialist countries, of which the UK is a prime member, who do not see themselves as upholders of international laws, but arbiters of international laws, which means to say they get to decide what constitutes war crimes and what does not. And in this case, what we are seeing is the white supremacy of the British imperial state at work. Its soldiers can never be accused or prosecuted for committing war crimes. Because why? Because they're on the good side in this eternal war against the black and brown other. No ifs, no buts, no maybes.
Let me also welcome our next guest. Out of London, author and political commentator, Jonathan Fryer. Jonathan, thanks so much for being with us. Now, Jonathan, the reason the ICC says it is dismissing this is because the UK is investigating itself. Your take on what exactly that means?
Well, there have really been two stages to the British investigation.
for several years up until 2017 was something called the Iraq Historic Allegations Team, or IHAT, and they had legal teams in court which listened to the claims of people from Iraq who said that they had been tortured or mistreated in various ways. And there were well over 3,000 such claims. And although 70% were dismissed as perhaps unreliable, that still meant that hundreds of people had got legitimate claims. But in fact, the cases fell apart because of the evidence not being strong enough. And instead, what's happened is that now the British military themselves are looking into any prolonged appeals. And it was interesting that the ICC, in its judgment in abandoning the case, now has said that they did believe that the British military were looking at this. But of course, for the victims and their families, there is no justice in this.
Well, now, John, do you think that for international organizations such as the ICC, that the value of lives differ depending on the part of the world one is from?
Well, indeed, yes. We live in a world underpinned by the values of might is right rather than right is might. And the IEC in this decision has proven itself to be unfit for purpose. We need to move beyond this idea that a certain group of countries based on military might and economic power have the right to determine what is just and what is not just. If these were Iranian troops, if these were Venezuelan troops, if these were Cuban troops involved in these activities or accused of these activities, it would be an entirely different narrative. This is about imperialism, no ifs, no buts. And I just have to say this. I am appalled as a citizen of the United Kingdom how dehumanized people of Iraq, of Syria, of Iran have been treated in terms of their value. And they have been pushed outside the circle of human worth that is established in the name of Western imperialism. And this is a very, very sordid and squalid turn of events. And I hope many people in the West will finally wake up to the injustice and the barbarism and the cruelty that has been perpetuated in their name. And unless they do, the world is headed for perdition. This is nothing more than imperial power writ large. There is no justice here. There is no legal pretext here. It's all about power. And until we move beyond that and move into a world where it's about underpinned by justice, regardless of country, regardless of culture, then, I foresee that we're headed for a very bad end.
Jonathan, ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda says that the UK has been using mechanisms to investigate itself, but then admits that this 10-year investigation has not led to anyone being convicted. It's quite amazing that on the one hand, she's saying that they are capable of actually judging themselves, but on the other hand, no one has been convicted and paid a price. So as our other guest said, would it be the same thing if we were talking about another country such as Iran or, as he said, Venezuela?
Well, it might well be different in those cases. One can't know unless a particular case comes before. As I mentioned earlier, the problem was in the case of British soldiers in Iraq that the evidence was not strong enough linked to individual soldiers or commanders that would actually enable anybody to be successful.
Jonathan, who determined that the evidence was not strong enough? The ICC?
The ICC accepted what the British had, the British government and the British military had decided through the Iraqi
historic problem right there.
And that what we have a situation, though, I think we have to admit, and probably John would agree with me on this, is that the real problem is the whole idea of European or North American countries intervening in a situation such as Iraq. Many millions of people, including myself in Britain, demonstrated against the Iraq war and thought it was a terrible mistake. And those sorts of interventions in countries that have a completely different culture and ethnicity and so on, almost inevitably lead to various types of abuses. And this is something which I think has to be approached, and I would say in two ways. First of all, that these sorts of interventions should not be entered into as lightly as they have in the past. And secondly, the rules of engagement need to be much more closely monitored so that people are not able to commit the sort of abuses which undoubtedly happened in the case of Iraq.
Well, Jonathan, you're just jumping in here, listening to what you're saying, but at the end of the day, you say that they should not, these countries like the UK, should not be involved or not get involved very easily or lightly in these regions. But of course they do. And on the other hand, the ones who are paying the price are the people of this region, not the aggressors, not the ones that are coming in. At the end of the day, if we're looking at, for example, Iraq, that millions of people have been displaced. That country has never gone back to the where it was prior to the war. Yes, Saddam Hussein is gone, but so is security and so many other things. And so many people have been tortured, and so much abuse has taken place. So then the question is, so who pays? Who pays? We're looking right now at the ICC saying, well, the Brits are going to investigate themselves, but these were the same ones, based on a lie, who went into the country to begin with, that they had no right to go into, because, of course, we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
Well, I agree, Marzia, absolutely, that the intervention in 2003 was not only unjustified, but as many of us would believe, totally illegal. But we have a situation when you say who is going to pay for what has happened in Iraq, and it is a tragic case. It is unfortunately many of the individual citizens and the communities in Iraq who are paying the price, and it's a terribly high price, which is why there needs to be a complete rethink of, as I said, of engagement in foreign wars and foreign interventions.
Okay. Jonathan, let me get John back in on this. Yeah. John, do you think that this verdict from the ICC prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, is connected at all to what happened back in September when Bensouda and the ICC ruled that there was enough evidence to investigate the U.S. for war crimes in Afghanistan? And after that ruling, the U.S. sanctioned her. Do you see any type of connection that perhaps there are threats, intimidation being exerted on her? Your thoughts on that side of things.
Well, there's absolutely a connection here. I mean, but I just need to go back to something Jonathan said. Jonathan Fry is somebody that I hold in the highest esteem, but I must take exception to his description of the war in Iraq as a mistake. Nomenclature is very important before it unlocks the keys to human consciousness. This war was not a mistake, it was a crime. It was a war crime, it was an atrocity. And the problem that we have in British culture is that every war since the Second World War is perceived and is presented as a rerun of the Second World War, i.e. the good war, i.e. that we are the good guys in this war and that who we are up against are the bad guys. Saddam's Hitler, Rouhani's Hitler, Maduro's Hitler, Castro's Hitler. Do you understand the pattern here? This is national myth presented to the British public as reality. We are the good guys, we are never the bad guys, and our troops can never commit atrocities. Until we break free from these shackles of false consciousness, then I say the world will always be in a perennial state of destabilization, of chaos, of mayhem, and of huge human suffering. Peoples of the global south cannot afford our propaganda any longer because it has been the result, it has been the product of their unremitting suffering. We must bring this to an end, and it's incumbent on people like me and Jonathan to be people in the West, in Britain, to make that case unremittingly, regardless of the personal cost to us and our careers.
Well, Jonathan, when the U.S. treats an international organization in the way that Washington treated the ICC, doesn't it show the lack of sovereignty and legitimacy that perhaps the ICC has to begin with?
Well, of course, the United States and its behavior is a particular case, which one shouldn't generalize with other countries necessarily in Europe. the United States has never been shy of putting pressure on other countries or institutions such as the ICC, and as you know, it refused to engage with the ICC and has withdrawn from other international treaties and organizations because it refuses to accept the universal nature of the international law and the rule of law. And as we've seen with the policy towards Iran, of course, and with maximum pressure under the Trump administration, they are prepared in Washington not only to put pressure from America, but also to coerce other countries to try to get them to follow suit. One hopes that this situation will change over the coming months, and certainly there is great resistance amongst many European countries into being coerced in that way, and there's great support for the work of the ICC amongst most European member states.
Well, John, the majority of cases prosecuted by the ICC deal with African countries. This seems to hint at the high level of abuse which has been committed by African leaders. However, if we look at the number of people killed and affected in Afghanistan and Iraq by the U.S.-led coalition, one would assume that countries such as the U.K. and the U.S. should be at the top of the agenda of ICC for investigating and prosecuting war crimes. Your thoughts?
Well, Malcolm X said it best. I mean, if you don't understand what's going on in the Congo, you can't understand what's going on in Mississippi. There is a circular relationship between the social and economic injustice taking place in Western countries and the foreign policy of imperialism, colonialism, and oppression that is underway perennially by those same Western countries. And people who are the victims of oppression in those Western countries, until they wake up to the reality of their condition and their whys and wherefores, then there will never be freedom for the rest of the world. And I just hope and pray that people in the US, people, the 40 million who lack healthcare, the families of the over 200,000 who have died from COVID, the families of the over 60,000 who have died from COVID in the UK, they wake up to the reality and move beyond the propaganda, the flag waving, the nationalism, the sense of patriotism. Until they move beyond that, then the world, never mind themselves, but the world will not be free. And I look forward to that day happening soon. I really do hope so.
Well, we all hope so, that's for sure. But Jonathan, when there is so much inequality in the international arena, even the criminal court, doesn't this send a message to developing countries that they must strengthen themselves militarily because might makes right?
Well, I certainly would agree that developing countries have every reason to be disappointed, to put it mildly, in the way that the ICC has tended to focus on Africa. There have been a few other cases recently which are a little more broad, but I would not particularly want to urge countries to spend their scarce resources on yet more military weapons. One of the problems of developing countries, including in Africa, is that too many governments spend far too much on arms and not enough on making sure that their populations are properly fed and educated. So although I can understand the resentment, I think rushing out to buy more arms is not the answer.
What your thoughts on that, John? Because it seems that that is exactly the signal that is being sent, that you have to be strong militarily, and basically you can get away with anything. Now, what Jonathan said when talking about African countries,
in theory, Jonathan is absolutely correct, but in reality, they have no choice because they're under risk of being invaded. Ask Muammar Gaddafi's ghost if he should have spent more money on arms, if he should have given up his chemical weapons program in 2003 when he did. Ask the people of Iraq. Ask the people of Iran who are suffering under these barbaric sanctions if they think their country should spend less on arms in order to put up a deterrence against the vultures that are circling their country right now. This is all about racism. It's racism writ large. It's colonialism, it's imperialism in our time. And imperialism is the external oppression of white supremacy. And until we move beyond white supremacy, there will be no progress and there will be no emancipation for the entire world.
How do we move beyond, John? How do we move beyond this white supremacy? What's key right now?
We are living in a period of interregnum between the dying of the old world, and the coming into being of the new. The rise of China, the strategic threat of Russia, that is the new world. The sun is setting in the west and it's rising in the east. But in the period in between is a period of struggle, and it's a very dangerous period because no empire leaves the stage of history without a hard-fought struggle. And that struggle is being waged now. And I just hope that the people of Iran, of Venezuela, of Cuba, of Russia and China continue to hold the line, because people in the West of consciousness and conscience are depending on them to free us all.
And on that note, I appreciate both of you being with me on this debate. Author and political commentator Jonathan Fryer out of London and out in Edinburgh. John White, author and commentator. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashemi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, dear brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll discuss the 22nd chapter of the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Hajj, or Pilgrimage. Before moving on, let's just listen to some verses of this chapter, and we'll be back with you. Stay with us.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Alladhina immakkan
And they are those who, if we give them authority in the land, establish prayer and give zakah and enjoin what is right and forbid what is wrong. And to Allah belongs the outcome of all matters.
The verse under discussion was the 41st verse of the chapter. الَّذِينَ إِمَّكَّنَّهُمْ فِي الْأَرْضِ أقاموا الصلاة وآتوا الزكاة. Those, if we establish them in the land, perform prayer and pay the alms. وأمروا بالمعروف ونهوا عن المنكر. And enjoin good and forbid evil. ولله عاقبة الأمور. And unto Allah belongs the end of all affairs. Through these verses, the group of verses we recently discussed in this chapter, somewhere he commands the Prophet wasallam to give glad tidings to the righteous, the good doers, or muhsineen, and then Almighty Allah introduces them as those who have faith and are not treacherous and ungrateful. In the 38th verse, the Almighty Allah said, إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُدَافِعُ عَنِ الَّذِينَ آمَنُوا إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يُحِبُّ كُلَّ خَوَّانٍ كَفُورٍ. And somewhere in the Holy Quran, he refers to the humble ones, or مُخْبِتِين, and explains them as those who, when mentioning name of Almighty Allah, tremble heartily and are patient under that which afflicts them. And they establish prayer and spend in charity out of whatever good Almighty Allah has provided them with. And then, finally, the qualities of the helpers of Almighty Allah are explained, as that at the time of victory, they do not pave the way of disobedience, but they establish prayers, they pay the alms, they enjoin good and forbid evil. Dear listeners, the totality of these verses prove that from one side, the true believers who are qualified with these attributes are very strong in faith and in feeling responsibility, and on the other hand, they are very steadfast and practical from the point of action in the aspects of relationship with the Almighty Allah, and of course, keeping their connection with the servants of Almighty Allah, as well as struggling against the corruption in the society.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
we
approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran. By Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom.
Speaking of corruption, we talked about the word ma'ruf and munkar in the mentioned verse. The Arabic word ma'ruf is derived from arafa, and it philologically means known, while the term munkar is derived from inkar, which means unknown. So the good deeds are some known things, while the wrong and indecent actions have been introduced as some unknown affairs. And we explained to you, dear listeners, as you may remember, that the nature of the man is somehow acquainted with the first group, and it is unacquainted with the second group. So some people do actually try to familiarize themselves with the second group, which is unknown affairs, which is al-munkarat. But this is not something we're going to talk about now. It's not our business now. The question we're trying to answer is the question that some people may ask. Is enjoining good an intellectual duty or it is devotional? Some Islamic scholars believe that these two duties, as obligatory, have been proved by only traditional evidence. An intellect does not command that a person hinders another one from doing an evil deed or the kind of deed the harm of which returns only to the same oneself. But however, regarding the social relations, and that no indecent deed in the society stops in a particular point, but on the contrary, whatever it may be, it can, like fire, reach other points harmfully, and thus these two duties are recognized as intellectual. In other words, there is not anything found in the society under the title of personal harm, and every personal harm may change into the form of a social harm. That is why both logic and intellect allow the individuals of the society not to stop effort and endeavor in purifying their own environment from any pollution. Some Islamic traditions have pointed to this matter, and we will inshallah talk about them in the next program. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Reporters.
A typical day in the life of mother of four, Naomi Rantry, founder and CEO of Educare Family Support Service, a fundraiser in West London that uses public donations to help children and families during the pandemic.
We started this food parcel delivery in May, so we did that for about 13 weeks. The numbers were just increasing. We started on 7 on our first week, and it ended up being 200 every week.
First stop, a school. Earlier this year, the British government had to reverse its decision not to offer free school meals in the Christmas holidays, following a campaign by football star Marcus Rashford. Still, more help is needed.
If there's an issue financially, we could support them with maybe some debt management, some financial assistance. In other areas, it might be school uniform they need support with.
People who use food banks are generally double-income, low-wage earners. in struggling families, all it takes is for one parent to lose their job. Karina used to work in the tourism sector in central London.
I used to work part-time on a 0 hours contract, and it was like a normal life for me. Now I'm on a minus because I've stopped working. I had to ask for help. I never knew about food bank. I just found out since I was on a financial difficulty.
Living in a nondescript apartment in West London, Karina, whose husband does food deliveries, not only has to care for her 3-year-old daughter, but also her ailing father, who lives alone.
Everything starts to go really bad with him. Sorry, I'm crying. And because I'm the one who's obliged, you know, to help him, to look after him, because he's my only parent.
The Trussell Trust, that runs 1,200 of the UK's 2,000 food banks, say they gave out more than 1 million emergency food packages between April and September. Nearly 500,000 went to children. They also warn these figures are the tip of the iceberg.
Nearly 2 million people have used a food bank in the UK in the past year, almost 300,000 more than the year before. While the government has taken steps, charities say they're not enough, which is why they're relying on donations from the public to try and tackle hunger in the world's sixth largest economy.
In the absence of an income, many adults living with children in this country have reported skipping meals in the last 8 months. It's the last month of the year, and the nation of nearly 67 million is gearing up for Christmas. Without adequate government support and with food banks under strain, poverty may well rear its ugly head in more British homes. Saeed Pureza, London.
Give us a decent housing, requisition of empty buildings. That's what the protesters demand from the French government. With the support of human rights associations, these homeless or poorly housed people have made a list of huge empty buildings in the Paris area. They handed over this list to the police headquarters and required that the housing law be applied.
We can apply this law to house everyone, even the precarious homeless French. Thanks to this law, everyone can have a roof above his head. If everybody were housed, that would already resolve half of our problems. It would help us to continue other fights, like work and against discrimination. The requisition law exists. It has to be applied.
I don't have a house. I'm moving from here to there. Once they proposed me a studio with toilets and a bathroom outside, I was disappointed. Now it's been more than 3 years I'm demonstrating with this association, Right to Housing, because they do the right thing.
This building in the center of Paris is entirely empty. This building in the rich 8th district of Paris is also entirely empty. Same for this huge building in the Boulevard Haussmann, another rich area in Paris. The owners are often big insurance or real estate companies, and the value of these buildings increases more by leaving them empty than by renting the space to people. That's called speculation.
We have a law of acquisition of empty buildings, housings, and offices, but it is not applied nowadays. In Paris, the prefecture, therefore the government, can apply this law of acquisition. But we see that the politic of the government is to favor the property rights and the rights to speculate on property rather than right to housing.
300,000 persons are homeless or poorly housed in France. The needs for decent housing are growing. A solution could be simple. In France, 3 million of buildings, houses and apartments are empty. Millions of square meters of offices are left vacant, a record in French history. The requisition law exists since 1945. The last time it was implemented was in 1997. Under the rain and with the cold coming, a growing number of people are in a need for housing, and a decent housing policy is becoming urgent. Chris Denant, Paris.
Afghans are yet to wait for the rise of peace in their war-ravaged country, as the ongoing war in Afghanistan continues to claim the lives of large numbers of civilians, including women and children, on a daily basis. According to rights bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, Over 30,000 civilians were killed and more than 60,000 others, including women and children, injured in the Afghan war over the past 11 years. All conflicting sides, including terrorist groups, U.S.-led NATO troops and pro-government forces, are being blamed for these casualties. However, some international bodies like the United Nations Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, and other independent bodies, including Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission, named chiefly terrorist groups accountable for much of these casualties. They also call on the Afghan government to bring the killers of Afghan people into justice via any possible legal attempt.
Unfortunately, nearly 100,000 civilians, including women and children, have fallen victim to the war in Afghanistan over the past 11 years. We call on the government to share its findings about these deaths and bring the accountable figures to justice.
This comes as experts believe there would be no zero civilian casualties unless the Taliban militant group changes its mind and accepts a new Afghanistan that differs from what it was before 2001.
Approval of a ceasefire by Taliban is highly important. They must realize that remaining indifferent to the sufferings of people will have dire consequences.
Violence has been rising in Afghanistan amid intra-Afghan talks in Doha and U.S. troops withdrawal. Afghanistan remains in the 11 most dangerous nations list for children, according to Save the Children. Meanwhile, the International Committee of the Red Cross reported last month that Afghanistan remains the deadliest country for civilians. Half of the civilian fatalities include Afghan women and children. Syed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
EU leaders told Turkey in October to stop exploring in the contested eastern Mediterranean waters or face consequences. Earlier this week, all EU states agreed that in their view, Turkey has made no positive shift away from its policy of exploring in contested waters and upped its threat of sanctions. Ankara urged the EU to act with common sense to solve the dispute. But ahead of Thursday's EU summit, Turkey's president made his stance very clear.
Any sanctions decision that can be taken against Turkey will not concern Turkey much. Since 1963, the EU is officially constantly imposing sanctions on us anyway. The EU has never acted honestly.
Germany, the current holder of the EU's six-month presidency, holds the key to whether sanctions will go ahead. However, Turkey resuming its gas exploration off Cyprus in October has angered Berlin.
In recent months, Germany has made an extraordinary effort to find a way to intensify the dialogue between Turkey and the European Union. Regrettably, tensions between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece have not allowed direct talks to begin, and there have been far too many provocations.
Turkey's row with Greece and Cyprus over the extent of their continental shelves in the East Mediterranean flared up in August when Turkey sent a survey vessel to waters claimed by Greece. The two European nations accuse Ankara of drilling for hydrocarbons off its continental shelf. Turkey pulled the vessel out in September to allow for diplomacy with Greece, but then sent it back to the area, prompting an angry reaction from Greece, France and Germany. However, Ankara seems unfazed.
On the eastern Mediterranean, we will continue to protect our rights. Moreover, we will continue to protect the rights of northern Cyprus until the end. It is never possible for us to compromise here. But if Greece really acts honestly as a neighbour, we will continue to be available at the table.
The EU created a sanctions program last year to punish what it calls unauthorized exploration in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, freezing assets of people and companies accused of planning or participating in activities in Cyprus's exclusive economic zone or on its continental shelf. Only senior officials of Turkey's state-owned Turkish Petroleum Corporation were put on the sanctions list, but that was not enough for Greece. It is a delicate situation for Germany, having to mediate between two NATO members, Ankara and Athens, without seeming to have divided loyalties. Bianca Rahimi, London.
leaders meeting in Brussels have adopted proposals aimed at trying to avert chaos at EU-UK borders in the event that Britain abruptly exits the bloc's rules and regulations at the end of this month when the Brexit transition period ends on the 31st of December. This as floundering trade talks between both sides continue.
No one understates the challenges that lie ahead, but it's important for the citizens of Europe that we do everything we possibly can to get agreement here.
France has made it clear it will veto any EU-UK trade agreement that does not safeguard the livelihoods of those involved in the French fishing industry. The big sticking point for Germany is ensuring that British firms do not have unfair advantage over EU firms, for example, via state subsidies. Hardline Brexiteers do not want to see a deal, as they are worried this would align the UK too closely to the EU. Equally, there are many people in the European Union who adjudge London to be extremely arrogant. This cohort does not want to see a deal, as they'd rather look on as Britain faces the full consequences of Brexit. Those consequences might include very restricted travel to the EU from the UK from January the 1st due to the 27-nation bloc's COVID-19 rules with respect to non-members. British citizens living in the EU would likely face all sorts of bureaucracy. Then, of course, there are warnings of dire economic consequences for the UK and possibly Scottish independence. We are told the key to securing a EU-UK future relationship agreement to avoid chaos in January is fairness.
This fine balance of fairness has not been achieved so far. Our negotiators are still working, and we will take a decision on Sunday.
Even in the absence of a trade deal with the UK, EU leaders know they already face many economic challenges.
We still haven't fully resolved the problems of very high public debt, private debt still very high, banking sector problems still very present, price adjustments still ongoing.
The prospects aren't looking good. As EU leaders continued their meeting in the Belgian capital, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson stated there is a, quote, strong possibility a trade deal will not be reached. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The administration of US President Donald Trump is given the go-ahead to sell billions of dollars worth of arms to the UAE. On Wednesday, the Republican-led US Senate approved the deal proposed by the government. The contract, reportedly worth some $23 billion, includes the sales of the U.S.'s most advanced F-35 fighter jets and Reaper drones. Senators voted almost along party lines on two resolutions. All but two Democrats voted to block the deal, while one Republican broke ranks to vote against the sale. Trump had issued a formal threat to veto congressional efforts to block the weapons transfer. Those in favor of the deal described the UAE as an important U.S. partner in West Asia. Detractors, on the other hand, argued the UAE should not be armed with advanced weapons given its involvement in the war on Yemen. They also warned that such a move would ignite an arms race in the region. A couple of months ago, in a controversial move, the UAE normalized its relations with Israel. The country trampled upon years of at least verbal commitment to the Palestinian cause by recognizing Israel. It also distanced itself from the majority of the Arab countries that have no diplomatic relations with Israel over the regime's occupation of Palestinian lands. The UAE's recognition of Israel was said to be a precondition for its purchase of advanced weaponry from the United States. Therefore, F-35 jets and Reaper drones can be considered the payoff for turning their back to Palestinians. The United Arab Emirates, which is ruled by monarchs, has a bleak human rights record. The country is a staunch Saudi ally, the two of which have been leading a devastating war on Yemen since March 2015. The war has killed thousands of innocent Yemenis, including women and children, and has caused what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The UAE also openly supported anti-government militants in Syria, exacerbating the suffering of the Syrian people by fueling the bloodshed in the Arab country. It has also been actively engaged in a brutal suppression of a popular pro-democracy movement in neighboring Bahrain. Abu Dhabi is now eyeing to seize control of southern Yemen, including a strategic island there, using its proxies.
Iran and Afghanistan have launched a railway that connects the Iranian northeastern city of Khaf to Herat in the other country. Iran's President Hassan Rouhani and his Afghan counterpart Ashraf Ghani attended the inauguration ceremony through video conference due to the global corona epidemic. The two sides said the project is a pivotal one that helps boost bilateral economic ties and collaborations.
With the completion of such an important project, the commodities of your businessmen could easily be transferred to Europe. With this railway, you can have access to Iran's southern ports, including Imam Khomeini Port and Bandar Abbas, and later on to Chabahar.
For his part, the Afghan president also said that the important project will give fresh momentum to economic ties between the two countries.
We jointly put iron on earth and soil to tie the destiny of the two nations to outline our future collaborations. I offer congratulations and wish the best for the two nations and governments.
The railway is about 140 kilometers long, and after being connected to Herat, it will be about 225 kilometers.
The Khaf-Herat Railway will enhance economic, cultural, and social exchanges between the two countries. It will see over 6 million tons of goods transported annually. It will also link Afghanistan through Iran to the Caspian Sea, Russia, and Europe. Humana Abedi, Tehran.
The news that people in the United Kingdom are already getting the COVID-19 vaccine has given hope to millions of families across the globe. Families with elderly or vulnerable members are wondering when it will be their turn. According to the People's Vaccine Alliance, which includes Amnesty International and Oxfam, it might be a while. The organization says rich countries are hoarding the most promising vaccines, just as they did during the swine flu pandemic in 2009. Moderna and Pfizer-BioNTech have so far sold out, despite promises of fair distribution.
We set out at the beginning to deliver this vaccine to the world, and that means fair allocations across all countries that wish to use and have our vaccine. So no, not all of the doses that we produce go to the UK. The UK gets, like every country, a fair proportion.
Rich countries have bought more than half the globe's supply of vaccines. That means 1 in 10 people in at least 67 poor countries will not get it unless urgent action is taken. This contradicts statements made by rich nations at the UN after General Secretary Antonio Guterres called on them to make vaccines available to all.
France proposes a donation mechanism so that a portion of the first doses of vaccines available are used to vaccinate priority groups in developing countries.
To end this pandemic anywhere, we have to end it everywhere. We need a united global effort that ensures that everyone has equitable access to a potential vaccine.
Experts say this is blatantly hypocritical, though. Canada has purchased enough vaccines to immunize its entire population 5 times over. The same goes for the world's highest per capita buyer, the United Kingdom. Meanwhile, countries that are subject to US-led sanctions are being prevented from purchasing the vaccine. Iran is one of them. The US has imposed crippling sanctions on its banking sector and its vital oil and gas industry, and threatened punitive measures against any country or company that does business with Iran.
The pandemic has shown what humanity is capable of at its best and worst. Inspiring acts of compassion and self-sacrifice, breathtaking feats of science and innovation, and heartwarming demonstrations of solidarity, but also disturbing signs of self-interest, blame shifting, and division.
The UN is calling for a global ceasefire, debt relief for struggling nations, and a lifting of sanctions amid the COVID-19 pandemic. But it seems these calls have so far fallen on deaf ears. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan criticized U.S. administration's comments and actions against Turkish arms deal with Russia. In a presser, Erdogan, however, said he would discuss Turkish-U.S. relations with the next president once he takes office, just like it was the case before.
Aklına herhangi bir şey gelen bakıyorsunuz.
happen.
Once he assumes office, we will surely sit down and discuss certain things with Mr. Biden, just like we sat down and talked in the United States or Turkey in the past. We will discuss these again. We do not find the statements and actions they make regarding our arms procurements to be nice. We especially don't find their approach in northern Syria to be right.
Turkey and the U.S. ties have been hit by Turkey's purchase of S-400 missiles from Russia after the U.S. was unable to seal a deal on Patriot missiles. Despite the ongoing tensions and sanction threats, everyone could see the chemistry between Erdogan and Trump. The chemistry that Erdogan-Biden relation is definitely not going to have. Analysts worry about the future of relations between Ankara and Washington.
Turkish President's statement on Turkish-U.S. relations is aimed to build a good relation with Washington, especially now that Joe Biden will take office. However, it is not guaranteed that things will go well due to differences between the two allies. The U.S. still insists on its support to Kurdish militants and tries to impose its strategies on Turkey, which is not acceptable for the government here. Therefore, I think tensions will continue to escalate between the two states.
The tension between the two NATO allies goes back to 2003, when Ankara refused to permit U.S. troops to cross its borders to Iraq. The tensions escalated due to different views on the Syrian crisis and Turkey's purchase of S-400 from Russia. Despite the ongoing tensions, many believe that both Ankara and Washington need each other's support in different arenas. This will force Erdogan and Biden to talk things out. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, he is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyyi al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد. وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره. Last night we spoke about the way that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has provided humanity with guidance for their personal progress and also for establishing a community, a universal community based on justice as a major value and other values that inshallah we will talk about it. When it comes to personal progress, all the prophets helped humanity in order to combat their ego, in order to combat temptations coming from their nafs ammare, their commanding soul, from Satan. They tried to take them from darkness to light. But when it comes to establishing a just society, it was the job of the messengers, of the Rusul, who were given the book and mizan, the scale or the balance, so that they would lead and guide humanity towards establishment of this social justice. لقد